See all of you here. Obviously, got a lot of people traveling, spring break, and a lot of things are going on. Steve and Kay Lashley are out of town, and that's too bad because Steve and I have brief discussions from time to time about a really interesting idea. At least it interests us. I hope it's going to interest you as well. The question is that Steve has brought to me several times, and we've talked about several different aspects of it. Do details matter to God? Do details matter to God? And at first our reaction would be, well, yeah, think about that. Nadab and Abihu, guys, you remember? They offered the wrong kind of fire before God and died for that. But look, they were the right guys. They were in the right place. They had the right censers. They were wearing the right clothes. They had the right kind of incense. It was a very complicated blend that they'd put together and did it exactly right. And the only thing that they got wrong was that they used the wrong kind of ignition system. They used strange fire, and they died for that. Are details important? Well, it sure sounds like details are important. But then you stop and think, well, wait a minute, what about David? David went to the tabernacle and took bread for himself that he's not authorized to have. He's not one of the priests. He's not authorized to eat that bread. And he flat-out lied about his mission there. Fooled the priests that were there in the tabernacle to got away. And even Jesus seemed to think that that was okay. But do details matter to God? I left scratching our head about it. What about Matthias in Acts chapter 1? This is one that's always bothered me a little bit. See, here's the thing. As Jesus is about to ascend back to the Father, he's raised from the dead, he's been with him for about 40 days, he's about to ascend back to the Father, he says to the apostles, go back to the city, that's Jerusalem, go back to the city and wait there, you'll be clothed with power from on high. And he ascends back to the Father. They go back to the city and the first thing they do is look around and say, you know what, we need a replacement for Judas, because we need to be 12 and not 11. So they selected Matthias as an apostle. Now, Matthias, we see him in Acts chapter 1. He is selected as an apostle, and we never see Matthias again. And I kind of think that that wasn't really what Jesus had in mind, because Jesus selected his apostles. Other people didn't. Now, I think what Jesus had in mind was a guy by the name of Saul that was going to become Paul the apostle. He was going to round it out and make 12, not Matthias. But nothing very bad happened in that case. Does God care about details? Do we need to be careful about details? Now, the reason this matters so much to us is because we look out here at the religious world, we got a lot of nice people that we really like in other religious groups, and they're doing some things that we look at the Bible, and we see that that's not the right thing. And we ask ourselves, well, you know, God is a God of grace and love, but He's also a God of justice and wrath. Do these details matter to God? Is His grace just going to overshadow all that? Or will these details matter at all? Will He overlook their mistakes? I mean, we love these people. We care about them. We would like for them to be in a right relationship with God. We'd like them to be in full harmony with His will. Will God overlook their mistakes in their worship and their service and their thinking? And then you have to ask this also, will He forgive ours? It would be naive in the extreme to think that we don't make mistakes, that we've got everything perfectly wired and understood. I don't think that would be wise for us to adopt that position. Will God overlook their mistakes? Will He overlook our mistakes? Well, we read an incident in our daily Bible reading this past week that may give us some insight into this question. So I want you to go with me to Numbers chapter 20. It's probably been a long time since you heard a sermon out of Numbers, out of the book of Numbers. But in Numbers chapter 20, there's an incident that takes place here, kind of a famous incident. We're going to consider Moses' big mistake here in Numbers chapter 20. And I want to think about some of the details here. What I'd like to do is I want to read through the first 13 verses of Numbers chapter 20. We're in the fourth book of the Bible. If you start at the very beginning of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and then Numbers, here the fourth book into the whole Bible. We got Moses leading the Israelites out. What I want to do is I want to go to chapter 20, look at the first 13 verses here, and just take it really slowly and look at this with some detail. Just think about where we are and what's going on here. So, if you would,
read with me here as we start this. Oh, I need to give you a little background before we get started on it. You kind of need to know what's going on. From Numbers chapter 10 is the spies that go into the land. They come back and say, oh, we can't do it. It's too terrible for us. And God says, well, okay, then I'm going to let you wander in the wilderness for 40 years. From Numbers chapter 10 to Numbers chapter 20 is 38 years, folks. 38 years went by. And the reason we know that is because if you go over to Numbers 33 and verse 38, you find out that Aaron died in the 40th year. You go to the end of chapter 20 and Aaron dies. So we've got a date marker there way over in chapter 33, but the event takes place here in chapter 20. So in the second year, the spies went in, but this takes place in the 40th year. This is when Aaron dies. There are a lot of things that have gone on in those 38 years. A lot of things have happened. People were complaining and arguing, griping about what they didn't have and how bad it was out here. They're going to do it again here. Don't get too excited about that. You got Miriam and Aaron that opposed Moses. How did that come about? You've got the whole the spies and the rebellion thing that didn't work out very well, the rebellion of the people. You've got the rebellion by Korah and Dathan and Abiram and their followers, 250 followers that they had, and then the plague broke out. There's a lot of bad things that have happened, but it took 38 years for all of that to go on. And that's a limitation that we have. We see it all compressed in just a few pages. And we forget that it took a long time for some of those things to work out there. So in the meantime, in the 38 years that have gone on, a whole generation of people, nearly the whole generation, has passed away. There are very few left by now in this 40th year. The whole point of leaving them out there for 40 years was so that generation could die and another generation could come up in their place. But just about everybody connected with that generation now has died and buried out there in the wilderness someplace. And here we are in Numbers chapter 20, starting in verse 1. In the first month, the whole Israelite community arrived at the desert of Zin, and they stayed at Kadesh. There, Miriam died and was buried. Now, we got Miriam dead in verse 1. We've got Aaron dead at the end of the chapter. So, clearly, there's a big change taking place here. Miriam dies here and is buried at a place called Kadesh. Kadesh literally means, in Hebrew, it means holy. It is holy. It is a holy place here, Kadesh. Okay? Now, there was no water for the community, and the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. Oh, please. It's the same old story. They quarreled with Moses and said, "If only we had died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring the Lord's community into this desert that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? It has no grain or figs, grapevines or pomegranates, and there's no water to drink." Now, these are familiar complaints. We've read those several times before in Leviticus and also in Numbers and in Exodus, at the end of Exodus also. You know, all these similar complaints. But the thing you have to remember is this is a generation who can't remember anything about Egypt. They weren't there for the most part. Some of them were just little bitty children when they left Egypt. They might have a dim memory of grapevines and pomegranates. The rest of them don't have any idea what they're talking about. They're just repeating the myth that Mama and Daddy and Grandpa and Grandma talked about, how wonderful Egypt was and had these succulent fruits and all the fresh fish and cucumbers you could stand. And they're just repeating this stuff that they've heard. They don't know anything about this. Moses and Aaron went from the assembly to the entrance to the tent of meeting and fell face down, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. The Lord said to Moses, "Take the staff, and you and your brother Aaron gather the assembly together. Speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. You'll bring water out of the rock for the community so they and their livestock can drink." Now the staff that they're talking about, that's the one that Moses had used down in Egypt. You remember the parting of the Red Sea and became a snake and all those things. Struck the earth, became gnats. That staff had been laid up in the tabernacle for 38 years. See, it had just been in there, in the tabernacle with a lot of other things. Because the last time Moses used that staff that we know of was in Exodus chapter 17. In Exodus chapter 17, people are whining and complaining about, guess what? No water. And God said, take that staff and go strike that rock over there. And he did. Went over there and whacked that rock. The water came out. The people were able to drink. Life was spared. Oh, it's just wonderful. And ever since then, as far as we know, that staff has been in the tabernacle. And now God says, take that same staff and you walk out there and you speak to that rock and the water will come pouring out and those people are going to be saved. But see, the people outside didn't know what God had said to Moses. They didn't know what the actual commission was. So Moses and Aaron come out to them. So Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence, just as he commanded him. That's just the sort of thing you'd expect from Moses, isn't it? I mean, just as he commanded him. That phrase could be attached to Moses over and over, just as God commanded. Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence, just as he commanded him. He and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock. And Moses said to them, listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock? Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with his staff. Water gushed out and the community and their livestock drank. Back in Exodus chapter 17, when Moses had approached that other rock, he had said to the group, to the assembled multitude there, he said, why would you put the Lord your God to the test? And here he stands in front of the rock and he says, must we bring you water out of this rock? But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I give them. These were the waters of Meribah, where the Israelites quarreled with the Lord, and where he showed himself holy among them. They did not trust and honor God, so they also are going to miss the promised land. Moses and Aaron are not going in either. Meribah means strife, arguing, fussing, fighting. Meribah. But God was shown holy. He showed himself holy at Kadesh. Holy. Kadesh means holy. And we look at this story and we think, man, oh man, what a bad day. And we think, if I were there, if I were running the show at this point, I might have made some excuses for Moses. We look at this and we think, look, Moses put up, well, first of all, Moses put up with an awful lot from these people. Couldn't we give him a pass on this one? I mean, it's just a little exasperation here. Wouldn't you be exasperated? 40 years he's had to put up with this same nonsense, same complaints, same stories. These people don't know anything about it, and they're complaining. Couldn't we give him a pass on this? And then we might look at it and say, now, wait a minute, hold on just a second. See, the goal was water. These people need water. And Moses went out there. Yes, he struck the rock instead of speaking to it, but they got the water, didn't they? Isn't that good enough? Doesn't that satisfy the goal here? Or we might look at the whole situation and say, hold just a second. Whatever else you want to say, Moses has earned a place in the promised land. After all he's been through with 40 years of these people, he has earned it. You can't cut him off now. And doesn't God care more about people than he does about details? Wasn't that the whole message that Jesus had with David and the bread out of the tabernacle? Doesn't he care more about people than details? Well, what are the lessons here? Well, I think the first lesson is pretty obvious in this passage is if we believe God, we'll try to obey Him. If we believe God, we will actually try to obey Him. You know, in the Bible, the opposite of obedience is not disobedience. In the Bible, the opposite of obedience is unbelief. You think about the faith of Abraham. Man, this is a man who is told to do totally illogical things. He's told to leave his family and his friends and everything that's familiar to him and go to a land he knows not where. And he does it. And he obeys God because he believed God. You think about the missionary journeys that the apostles made, how they believed God and tried to obey Him as a consequence of their belief. Moses' fault here, according to Scriptures, Moses' fault is that he didn't trust God. He didn't believe Him. Because you did not trust in Me enough to honor Me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I give them. If we believe God, we will try to obey Him. I think it's really important that we kind of keep that in our minds. If we believe God, we're going to try to obey Him. Second lesson, I think, that seems obvious out of this passage is, you know, every single word that God speaks is important. Every word that He says is important. Now, I want you to go back and look at the in verse 8 for just a moment. Look at the details of what's going on here in verse 8. God says to Moses and to Aaron, and He says, take the staff, and you and your brother Aaron gather the assembly together, speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. You'll bring water out of the rock for the community so they and their livestock can drink. So look what happens. Start with me in verse 9. See what happens. So Moses took the staff. That's the right staff. All right, that's exactly what God said to do. God said, get the staff. Moses took the staff, just as the Lord commanded him. He and Aaron. And God said, you and Aaron go after. So he and Aaron go after. They got that part right, too. Okay, gathered the assembly together. Oh, it said gather the assembly together in front of that rock. And they gathered the assembly right there in front of that rock. And God said, speak to that rock. And they struck, or Moses struck the rock. And God said, it'll give you water. And it did. So we got 4 out of 5 things right there. And the people did not know what God had said to Moses. Moses knew, but they didn't know. He's in the temple, or he's in the tent at that point. They didn't know what God said. They assumed that was according to God's commission, I suppose. They got it almost right. And we might even think, you know, the word speak and the word strike are really close in English. They both start with S and end with K. Speak and strike. It'd be easy for him just to kind of misunderstand that. Maybe it's just a misunderstanding. Well, if it were English, we could go with that, but it wasn't. It was Hebrew. And in Hebrew, speak and strike are not even close. They are not at all similar sounding words. Jesus kind of thought that every single word that God said was really important. The reason I know that is because when the devil came to him and tempted him, Jesus said, it is written. He's quoting Deuteronomy 8 and verse 3. Man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Every word. And then later on in Matthew 22, he has this controversy with the Sadducees. You remember that resurrection thing? They come to him, they have this crazy scenario about resurrection. And whose wife will she be in the resurrection? Ha, 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 let's all have a good laugh and make Jesus look dumb. And Jesus, I suppose, lets them have their little snicker for a moment, and then he says, are you not in error because you do not know the Scriptures nor the power of God? And then he makes this big theological argument about the fact that God said, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Not I was the God of those guys that lived 2,000 years before. And I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, meaning that they're still alive. God's not the God of the dead, He's the God of the living. Jesus seemed to think that every single word that God said is important. I kind of think we ought to have the same attitude. I think every single word that God has said is important. Let me ask you a question about that. Here's a question for you to answer in the privacy of your own heart and mind. Is the word heart, H-E-A-R-T, little organ inside your chest there that's pumping blood, is that word important in Ephesians 5:19? See, in Ephesians 5:19, God says, sing and make melody with your heart to the Lord. Now, is that word heart important? You see, what happened there is Paul knew his Psalms really, really well, and he knew that in Psalm 133 and several other Psalms, 6 or 8 or 9 of the Psalms, there's a phrase in the Psalms that says, sing and make melody with a harp or trumpet or some other musical instrument is named there. Sing and make melody with a musical instrument. And Paul took that phrase right out of the Psalms and carried it over here to Ephesians 5:19, and he took that musical instrument out, threw that out, and inserted the heart. And now God is saying, sing and make melody with your heart. You think that word is important? I kind of think it's important. And I kind of think that Paul knew exactly what he was doing when he was operating under inspiration of God to put that instrument in our music and not tambourines and drums and trumpets and whatever. I think God knew exactly what. I think that word's important. When Peter said to the assembled multitude there on the day of Pentecost, repent and be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins, you think that word baptism is important there? I kind of think it is. You can decide for yourself, but I kind of think that in both cases, every single word that God says is important. And I think in his cooler moments, I think Moses would have agreed wholeheartedly every single word that God speaks is important. I think a third lesson that you see here in this passage is that God is the one who's the source of all blessings. I really do kind of feel for Moses here, and I'm sure you do too. We have a lot of sympathy for this man. This is a real human being, and this is a very, very difficult spot that he's in. But he stands there in verse 10 and says, listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock? Must we? Moses, you think you can do that? I don't think Moses can do it, because I think it's only from God. In fact, you know, I already alluded to Deuteronomy 8 and verse 3, man does not live by bread alone, but every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. If you skip further down into that chapter, that whole chapter is a warning. And it's a warning to the Israelites, when you get into the promised land, don't you forget that this, you didn't do this on your own. It's not by your power. God did this for you. Don't you ever forget that God is the source of all your blessings and all the good things that have happened for you. Boy, that's a timely reminder, isn't it? They're just about to enter the promised land, and the years are going to go on, and they're going to be wealthy with buildings that they didn't build and cultivated crop land that they didn't clear, and pretty soon they'll start feeling pretty big and powerful there, and maybe forget that God is the one who did all that for them. So God says, don't you ever forget. Don't you ever forget that every good and perfect gift comes down from the Father of lights, whom there is no change as of shifting shadow. That's James 1:17. Went way over in the New Testament. Don't you ever forget that God is the source of every good blessing. It's not that we're so smart, good-looking, powerful, well-educated, healthy, wealthy, and wise that we can make good things happen. All this comes from the hand of God. I think it's pretty important for us to be grateful. Yeah, we probably ought to be thankful to God for all the blessings that we've received and continue to receive from Him. There's one more lesson that I want to give with you. And this really, I think, is kind of the answer to Steve's question and our discussion about it, because we've gone around and around about this a couple times and thought, does God care about the details? Well, yes, He does, and at the same time, God is gracious. But we must not presume upon His grace. God is gracious, but we must not presume upon His grace. You go back and look at grace in operation in Moses' life. Come on. From birth, he was supposed to be murdered like all the other little Israelite boys. And in God's grace, he's preserved. And in this ironic turn of events, he winds up growing up in Pharaoh's household. We got a lot of grace in operation in Moses' life. Moses is called. to deliver the people of Israel. God protects him, shelters him, gives him success and all that. You see grace poured out on Moses again and again and again and again. It's grace that explains forgiveness. Why was David forgiven for his sin with Bathsheba? And as far as that goes, with the bread in the tabernacle. That's grace. How is Peter able to be forgiven for his 3 times denial of Jesus on the night that he's crucified? What's grace? God is gracious. But here's the question. God is gracious, but here's the question. I want you to go to Hebrews chapter 10 for the question. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 26. Now remember, God is gracious. He really is. That's not open for discussion. That's fact. But here's the question. If we deliberately keep on sinning after we have received the knowledge of the truth, no sacrifice for sins is left, but only a fearful expectation of judgment and of raging fire that will consume the enemies of God. Anyone who rejected the law of Moses died without mercy on the testimony of 2 or 3 witnesses. How much more severely do you think a man deserves to be punished who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, who has treated as an unholy thing the blood of the covenant that sanctified him, and who has insulted the Spirit of grace? There's the question. God's gracious. But the question is right there. You must not presume upon God's grace. Still, we got a lot of sympathy for Moses. My, oh my. It seemed like such a small thing. He struck the rock twice with a stick. And God's grace is so great. Why should it matter so much? Why should it be such a big deal? Well, let's think again about our initial objections to God's judgment in this, and let's just think about this. Our first one was, look, Moses put up with so much from these people. Isn't he entitled to one little moment of exasperation with them? And I'd say yes. I mean, my thought, I agree. I think he is entitled to a little exasperation. But that wasn't God's judgment. And I rather suspect that if we knew the whole truth of the matter, we might kind of rethink that. Our second objection to that was, hey, look, the goal was water, right? They needed the water, they got the water. What's the problem here? Actually, that wasn't the goal. The goal was to glorify God as the source of all blessings and life. And instead, Moses wound up glorifying himself. When we presume that we can know what God's goal is here, that leads to all kinds of sin because we ignore the means to get from here to there. We think, well, that's the goal that he wants, so we just ignore everything in between and we'll just go right for that goal. People have justified all kinds of things as, well, this is what God really wants. They've justified all kinds of sin. They've justified all kinds of departures in worship practices and service to God, and all because they think they know what the goal is and we can ignore the means. The goal is always to glorify God, isn't it? It's always about God. It's not about us. It's about God. Our third objection or judgment, anyway, mine would be, you know, Moses has earned it, folks. I mean, he has earned a spot in the promised land. But I have to tell you that nobody has ever earned salvation of God. It's always by grace. We don't earn it. It's always by grace. So here we are at the end of Numbers chapter 20, and Aaron dies. And pretty soon he's going to be joined by Moses. It's not going to be very long. There's still a lot of ink to be written down through the rest of the book of Deuteronomy, but by the end of the book of Deuteronomy, we leave Moses on top of Mount Pisgah, looking out over the promised land that he's not allowed to enter. His career is ended right there on the top of Mount Pisgah, tripped up by the details. But you know what? That's not the end of that story either. See, one day, 1,300 or so years later, one day Peter and James and John went up on a mountain with Jesus. And he was changed before their eyes into a radiant form they could hardly recognize. And with him appeared two others, Elijah, the great prophet, and Moses. He finally made it. And when he made it to the promised land, he came face to face with the ultimate grace of God in Jesus Christ. We're going to sing an invitation song, let you come to the ultimate grace of God in Jesus Christ. If you believe that He's the Son of God, and you're willing to confess His name before men, if you're willing to be immersed in water for the forgiveness of your sins, you can be raised to a new life with Him. If you're a Christian, though, and you have found that you've pretty much been presuming upon God's grace to forgive your persistent sin, please take a message from Moses. God is gracious. But go back and read that question in Hebrews again. How much more severely do you think we deserve to be punished who, knowing the truth, have insulted the Lord and the Spirit of grace? If you need to respond publicly to Jesus' invitation, we urge you to do it right now while we stand and sing the song.